Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Paul Muldoon is considered the most significant English language poet born since the Second World War. In November of 2022, then-Irish President Michael Higgins named Muldoon the 9th Ireland Professor of Poetry, an honor bestowed jointly by universities and cultural organizations in the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. It's a role akin to poet laureate for all of the country. His most recent book, Scanty Plot of Ground, A Book of Sonnets, is a new anthology of beloved classics, hidden treasures, and standout contemporary examples of this ever-vital and enthralling verse form. His latest poetry collection, Joy in Service of Rue Tagore, is now out in paperback. Muldoon is the author of more than 30 collections, served as poetry editor of The New Yorker, taught poetry at Princeton since 1987, and songwriting since 2013, and of course famously collaborated with Sir Paul McCartney to edit and write the introduction for The Lyrics, 1956 to the present. It is always a delight to welcome Paul Muldoon to this program. How are you, sir?
You know what? I'm in exceptional form.
Excellent.
That's the official position.
Well, that's good. That's very, very good.
Yes.
I'm curious as to is that been the way for a little while, or is this unusual?
You know, I try to keep myself somewhat upbeat. You know. And I'm not sure if my wife will absolutely agree with this, my own assessment of myself, but I try. And, you know, I'm sure as many of your guests and many listeners will know. I mean, it's at the present time, one has to do one's best, I believe, to keep whistling in the dark.
Right.
Keep one's spirits up.
Absolutely. I've heard this, and I don't know if it's true, and I'm curious as to your opinion, but that because of the of being a poet, that would perhaps not be let's say as overtly joyful than other writing aspects.
Well, there certainly is a history of poets being depressive, if that's what you're getting at.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, there certainly is that. But it's not a job. It's not a requirement for the job. At least
well,
I hope.
Thank goodness. Okay.
I hope it's not. But, you know, there's that line, poets in their youth begin in gladness, whereof doth come despondency and sadness. And, you know, having said that, that one tries to be upbeat. I mean, the truth is that being upbeat, I was listening to part of your program earlier on in the car, being upbeat is pretty much a dog bites man story. Nobody's really interested. So the news often does happen when a poem, say, has an element of sadness about it, perhaps, or the elegiac component, of course, which has been a staple of poetry right the way through the centuries. So, you know, if you ask your friend, how's everything going with your relationship, and they say, oh, I'm head over heels in love, that's nowhere near as interesting as, oh, you wouldn't believe what I have to put up with from Johnny or Jenny, you know? So it's just intrinsically more interesting. But, yes, I mean, for alas, there are a number of great, well, American poets, for example, we'll just go back a generation or two. I mean, two great poets who come to mind, and indeed both of them included in this anthology of sonnets, Robert Lowell and John Berryman. And, I mean, both of them lived, I suppose, pretty sad lives. You know, Lowell certainly was manic depressive. he somewhere along the way talks about, you know, the unhappiness that he has visited upon his friends and family, all because of a little excess salt or a lack of salt, I can't remember which, in the brain. And, you know, I'm sure that it was a tough life for both of those poets in terms of their personal lives. And but, you know, I certainly don't want to say that they made up for it by writing wonderful poems. Frankly, I think happiness on balance is more important than any poem.
Paul Muldoon is our guest, and the new book is Scanty Plot of Ground, a book of sonnets, and it is edited by Paul Muldoon. And you say in the introduction that part of the reason for the durability of the sonnet is its very duration.
Yes, I believe that to be true. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written it. But I didn't expect anyone to read it, and now here I am having to defend it. So, you know, one other really attractive thing about the poem, first of all, never mind the sonnet, most lyric poems have what I consider an admirable virtue, brevity. Right? And it's one of the reasons why I got into the poetry business in the first place, is that, I mean, I somehow imagined that because most poems were short, that it would be comparatively easier to write them than it would anything else. So brevity is a feature of most lyric poems, what we call lyric poems. But there's something about the duration. In terms of both the amount of real estate it takes up in the world, physically, the physical space, it happens on one page. And, I mean, a lot of study has been done on how we read a poem, say. And we don't necessarily read a poem beginning with letter, you know, the first letter or the first word, and then moving through it. There's something about the sonnet, we can almost take it in all at once. And there's a quote by a man called Michael Thune, who talks about the footage, the square footage of the real estate. And he says, formally, virtually every sonnet is, at least in part, a concrete poem that looks like a sonnet, which I think is a really interesting observation. So there's something about the amount of space it takes up, and then duration, of course, in the more conventional notion of the word in terms of time. And, I mean, what's astonishing about the sonnet, that scanty plot of real estate that you mentioned, is that it can contain so much, you know? And it, I mean, the density of the real estate, in many cases, not in all, but the density, the pressure per square inch, on the footprint of the sonnet is really quite wonderful. What can be done there? I mean, you can take in generations and history in ways that are, when you think about it, are unlikely. I mean, maybe I'll read one just to remind us of what we're on about here. And I'm thinking of Percy Bysshe Shelley's famous sonnet Ozymandias, which seems to, you know, include everything. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. I mean, it's astonishing to think that he manages so much in a mere 14 lines there. He takes in time. It's a discourse on time, on fame, on the mutability of humanity.
And how? What allows that to be able to be put so concisely? In as you say, something that has everything in it.
Well, I think, you know, it's there's something about that duration again, to use that word again, that allows a couple of things. It allows us to have a single major thought, or a single major thought with a confirmation of that thought, which is what happens in the two main styles of the sonnet are, of course, the Shakespearean. And that certainly is the case of the Shakespearean sonnet with its couplet at the very end, you know, which has a ba-boom aspect. Here right. We have this idea, and by heavens, don't we have that idea, kerpow. Ba-boom, right? That's the Shakespearean sonnet. But interestingly, the Petrarchan sonnet, the first Italian model, of course, they came via Petrarch into the English tradition, certainly, tends to be, here we have an idea, a big idea, and then we have a little variation on it. Right, with the eight lines establishing the notion, and crudely speaking, the final six lines, a little variation on it, maybe even a slight mild contradiction of it. So in a strange way, it's a form that has an idea and a half an idea. And I myself, for whatever reason, I'm someone, and I think I'm not unlike most people, is that one idea is almost as much as I can deal with, right? In fact, it's almost more than I can deal with. And I think that's one of the reasons why it has been so effective. And one can actually, in some cases, you can see, it's as if you can watch a mind in process. You can almost watch somebody think through something. Right? And I think that's part of it. And, but there is also, there's a mysterious aspect to it. I mean, it doesn't seem possible that, again, 14 lines could contain as much as Ozymandias does. You know, you could imagine that poem stretching to, you know, a 12-volume history of the ancient world.
Right. I'm fascinated by your pointing out in the last six lines just that fleeting contradiction.
Sometimes.
Yes, that's right. But it's almost like you're covering your bets.
Well, there's that, but also, you know, I think this is not true of everyone in our society, but in my own case, and many of my friends, I would tend not to be certain of anything, and I hesitate when I meet people who are certain.
Oh, I'm with you
about anything. And so, what I'm trying to get around to saying, is that most of us understand, either just from bitter experience, if nothing else, that nothing is quite as simple as it looks. and that even when we have cases that are seem pretty cut and dried, as it were, black and white, whatever term one uses, we know that maybe it's not quite as simple as that. And to entertain another opinion, as it were, or maybe a little corrective thinking, you know, that was, well, actually, you know, maybe, again, it's not as simple as that.
Paul Muldoon is our guest. The new book is Scanty Plot of Ground, a book of sonnets. He has edited this. It is just out from Faber and Faber. What brought you to want to do an anthology on sonnets?
Well, you know what? That's a very good question. Because, I mean, the business of being an anthologist is certainly not a way of winning friends and influencing people. I mean, I've done a few anthologies over the years. For example, I did an anthology called The Faber Book of Contemporary Irish Poetry. I did it, put it together in the mid-1980s, and there were a mere, rather unconventional anthology, a mere 10 poets in it. And so I exposed myself to a lot of complaints. And I may tell you something about that. Those complaints were not necessarily coming from the people who were excluded, though there was a bit of that, because that, of course, is one of the big talking points of all anthologies. Who's in? Who's out?
Right.
Yeah, that's the big question. Why didn't you put... Why have you got that Shakespeare sonnet and that Wordsworth sonnet when you could have had something else? It certainly... people get enthusiastic one way or another. Most... Funnily enough, my strongest memory of editing that anthology was a complaint, not from someone who was not included, but someone who was included. And the complaint was that there was more of some other person rather than themselves. So, as I say, to go back to your question, why indeed? It's a thankless business. But you know what? One of the reasons why I did it... frankly, is that this is a great moment for the sonnet. It's a great moment for the sonnet. Worldwide, I think, every moment's a great moment. In this country, at this moment, what's quite striking is the vitality of the black sonnet. A lot of black American poets are writing fabulous sonnets. Absolutely brilliant. And for whatever reason, I mean, there might be, you know, we could try to come up with reasons. But for whatever reason, most of the, I don't want to get into trouble here, but much of the very best sonneteering going on at the moment in this part of the world is coming from the wonderful community of black poets. So that's part of it. I think I wanted to, you know, every anthology is a moment's monument, right? To use a phrase that's used off the sonnet itself. Every anthology is a moment's monument. And in a strange way, I think, strictly speaking, this book comes out next Tuesday.
Yes.
But, you know, in a strange way, by Wednesday, it will probably be, wouldn't want to say defunct, but slightly passé. No, if the publisher is listening, I don't want to suggest.
Well, that's why we had you on a couple of days early before it comes out.
We're still in good time. No, the fact is that if one thinks about it, you know, being slightly out of date is a defining characteristic of the anthology. I'm certainly not suggesting that on Wednesday you shouldn't bother buying this book. You definitely should. but, do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes.
Yeah, because next week, with any luck, there'll be an absolutely brilliant sonnet published somewhere that we don't know about yet. And, you know, were I putting it together next week, that sonnet might be in it.
So let me ask you a question. When you talk about distinguishing characteristics, I spend a good deal of my free time, not what I'm reading for work, but my free time reading Irish literature and contemporary Irish literature.
Yes.
I'm interested in your thoughts of when we look at Irish theater, Irish plays, poetry, fiction. Is there a commonality, or is there a stark difference between those forms, those distinguishing characteristics?
Do you mean between the actual genres?
Yes.
I don't know if there is. I mean, as you describe your interest in Irish literature, I mean, that seems to me to be a full-time job.
Oh, yeah.
Keeping up with it. I mean, you have many hats, but that's a full-time job. And I find it astonishing. Every time I go back to Ireland, which is quite a lot, I mean, there are half a dozen new novelists who have sprung up in the last 10 minutes. And, I mean, prose fiction is particularly strong in Ireland at the moment. I don't want to be doing down the poetry business, certainly not. But it seems, I think on balance, this may be remembered as a period for Irish prose fiction. I mean, so many, and this is, of course, is not to speak of the tradition, which was also to keep up with the tradition, to keep up with reading James Joyce, never mind, or Beckett, never mind anyone else. That's a full-time job. And each time, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Joyce. He's probably my favourite writer. You know, every time I reread Joyce all the time, well, quite a bit of the time,
yep.
And every time I go back, I think, my heavens, I never noticed that before. This man is a genius.
And I never know. I think, did I forget that, or did I just not notice it, or what is there in there? And then you, at least I do. I will spend just gaps of time there that are just studying it and looking at it and just seeing how it's to see how it is constructed.
Well, it's brilliantly constructed. And to go back to the sonnet for a moment, Joyce, of course, started out as a poet. I mean, he found his proper métier, I think, in prose fiction. But, you know, there's a story told about him that somebody asked him how he'd got on during the day, and he said, well, I had a hard enough day. I wrote one sentence. I just got one sentence done. And his pal said to him, well, what's the problem? Did you not have the right words? Something along those lines. And Joyce supposedly says, well, actually, I had the right words. I just couldn't get them in the right order, which is, of course, a kind of calibration or a reworking of a term Coleridge used about the best ideas in the best order, the best words in the best order. But, you know, one of the reasons why he's so good is that he has put a lot of thought into it. And any sentence in Joyce bears scrutiny and will repay scrutiny, you know? And that's because, I'm not sure what the analogy quite is. Let's say it's an architectural analogy. You know, those sentences were built to last, you know? They're not jerry-built. And that's part of it. But so in terms of points of contact between the various genres, you know, I'd say, I know this may sound a little bit strange, because I don't think it's absolutely exclusively true of Ireland. Ireland is a country which is still finding its way in the world.
Yeah.
And the Irish are still finding their way in the world. They're finding their way through I mean, again, it may sound like a really weird thing to say, they're coming to terms with the English language, by which I don't mean that they're sitting back home, you know, speaking the old Gaelic. No, but they are willing to take the time to try to figure out things. Now, I'm certainly not saying that things are finished in this country. We haven't arrived there in this country either. But societally, I think there's more interest in trying to, for the individual, as a citizen, never mind as a writer, trying to figure out what the story is.
Paul Muldoon is our guest. I apologize for looking around. We have clocks, and they're all different times. So I apologize for that. But they're working on it. The new book, Scanty Plot of Ground, A Book of Sonnets, it is edited by Paul Muldoon. I can't tell you what an honor and a pleasure it is to have you here, to have you come in fairly regularly and share with us. It is one of the highlights for me, and I so appreciate you.
Well,
thank you very much.
Being on your program is a highlight for me. Thank you very much.
Be well. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAI.